Got the password?
Walt sent me.
Hello, and welcome to episode 139 of Walt Sent Me, the podcast devoted to the Walt Disney Company and its various subsidiaries. As always, I'm Kristen Lopez, joined once again by Todd Liebenow.
Hello, everybody.
And this week, we are going historical with a look at 1995's Pocahontas.
Historical is a stretch there, Kristen. I don't know.
We're going to talk about history. I thought we had already done this film years ago. Kind of shocked that we had not until this very moment. Before that, we have some news and a short. So let's jump into it. Todd, where are we starting with news this week?
Let's talk trailers. We got our first look at Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, one of the films that's due to be released from Marvel this year, though, you know, you never know with the way things are going. But So this is kind of a more obscure character. You know, this, we're not talking like a Captain America or Iron Man type of thing here, but your thoughts on Shang-Chi?
So I have no thoughts on this because I only looked at screenshots of this.
Oh, okay.
Really? I mean, I think it's interesting that we're getting this because this is a character that, if memory serves, is going to be introduced in The Eternals.
That I'm not sure about. I mean, I know that originally the release dates were flip-flopped for these two. You know, Eternals was supposed to come out this past Christmas, and then Shang-Chi, I think, right about now. But things have kind of gotten moved around a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's always great to have more diversity when we talk about the Marvel Universe, especially in the wake of the finale of The Falcon and the Winter Soldier,
which I haven't watched yet, so we won't talk about that this week, but yeah,
that series I have so many negative thoughts about that series. But I mean that's always great. We're getting into the deep cuts of the superhero world here, so it'll be interesting to see how this character is taken and if this again is better than Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
I thought the trailer looked really interesting. I mean, kind of the vibe that we've been getting all along as they've been talking about this, and now that we get a first look, is that it's really, kind of Marvel's attempt at doing a kung fu movie, kind of in the spirit of like Enter the Dragon or something like that, which I am always down for. I love kung fu movies. And the character Shang-Chi was, I guess, originally inspired by the popularity of Bruce Lee back in the 70s. So, they're kind of springboarding off of all that. So, it was definitely kind of a teaser. We didn't get a really deep look at things. We got just kind of fleeting glimpses of various things. But, I'm definitely down for it. Looks interesting. So, but speaking of Marvel movies, let's talk about some big news that happened right after we recorded our last episode. The thing that has been theorized all along here finally came to fruition, where it was announced that, yes, indeed, they are going to debut Black Widow in theaters, yes, but at the same time, it will be a premiere access on Disney Plus.
Not surprising. They had to do something.
Yeah.
I've been very vocal. I'm not ready to go into theater at all. So will I pay $30 to see Black Widow? Possibly. I have not actually bought anything from Premier Access on Disney Plus yet.
Yeah, me neither.
So it'll be interesting to see if this tends to get my dollars. It might. I mean, honestly, I can tell you the only one that I definitely know would get my money is Eternals or Jungle Cruise. I would pay money for that. So this is a maybe. This is a maybe for me.
You want to see the backside of water at home, I take it. So.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I'm down for any, weird movie that looks like it's riffing on The Mummy with Edgar Ramirez playing like some sort of like swamp thing. I'm interested in that. So yeah, I mean, I might rent this. But yeah, it'll, I mean, this was a foregone conclusion. They would have to please both comers because the numbers just aren't there yet, especially from the box office to really, you know, you got to hedge your bets. You got to get the money where you can from all avenues.
Yeah, though things are looking up a little bit. I mean, they're you know, numbers are starting to get up there with like Godzilla and Kong and things like that. But yeah, I mean, we're still a far cry from where we were. You know, this may be the one that makes me do the Premier Access just because, you know, it is kind of an event for our household when we go together and see a Marvel movie, things like that. And, you know, we haven't had that kind of opportunity. So, you know, I don't know that I will be patient enough to wait, you know, another 3-4 months or whatever it is before it becomes available to everybody on Disney Plus. So I may very well do that, but it's not till July that this happens, so we've got time. Speaking of the Disney Plus thing, though, one that was announced that it will be a Disney Plus premiere and it will not be Premier Access is Luca, which makes it the second Pixar film in a row to do that, and you know, kind of the almost the third, because Outward, or what is the name of that thing?
Onward.
Why did I say Outward? Onward, you know, only got like a 2-week theatrical run before they put it on Disney Plus back when the pandemic first hit. But yeah, Luca is going to go to Disney Plus. And from what I have heard, that Pixar is none too happy that they seem to be the ones that, you know, their films keep getting pushed to Disney Plus exclusively.
I mean, I would definitely be irritated if I was Pixar. I think that the belief from Disney is that these are old reliables that will definitely get eyeballs from children sitting at home who are not going to school regularly full time. But at the same time, Pixar is what gets the Oscars. I mean, we're recording this right before the Academy Awards, and Soul is a big contender right now. So I'm not really understanding why they're putting all the Marvel eggs in one basket with both theatrical and all access. The only thing I can think of is budget, you know, because the budget on Pixar is so much bigger, you have to fight for that premium. But Pixar movies make money, and it's very surprising that they're not going both ways.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit of casting news that came around. Indiana Jones 5, whatever it ends up being called, has had some casting news hit. I assume they're starting production here soon because it's supposed to come out next year. But we got word of a few folks joining Harrison Ford in the cast. First of all, we have Phoebe Waller-Bridge joining the cast. And then Mads Mikkelsen also, which I think everybody at first thought, oh, he must be the villain. But who knows? We don't know what's going on there. I know, Kristen, you're not big on the Indiana Jones films, but do you have any thoughts on this?
I mean, it's not that I'm not big on the Indiana Jones films. I just, you know, we're so okay. I feel that there is a very, very, very intense desperation from people who love these movies to not change anything and to make Harrison Ford play this character until he dies. And even then, maybe find a way to get him to keep playing
Harrison Ford wants to keep playing it. I mean, he's the one that keeps pushing. He, you know, Han Solo, he reluctantly came back for it, but he's always wanted to come back for Indy.
I mean, I too like money, so I get it. I get what you're saying. I mean, the interesting thing is the problem that I have is that this feels like it's going the way of the Die Hard franchise, which is, if you saw the last couple of Die Hard movies, it was John McClane's children just keep popping up and they're played by different actors, and in the hopes that one of them will be popular enough to carry on this franchise. And so I feel like after nuking the fridge in the last Indiana Jones, because Shia LaBeouf is now persona non grata, we can't do that. So the theory
nuking
that is
the
going
fridge.
Around,
I like that phrase, nuking the fridge. Is that like jumping the shark?
No, like in Indiana Jones 4.
No, I know, but I thought like, oh, you could make that into a new catchphrase.
That is a catch. It's our idea. I cannot take credit for that. That's already been a phrase. Because
I guess
of that
I'm
movie.
Out of touch.
But there is a theory going around that Phoebe Waller-Bridge is going to possibly play Indiana Jones's daughter. And that the belief is that she can take on the franchise. Don't get me wrong, I love Fleabag. So I love Phoebe Waller-Bridge. I love anything she wants to do. She was the best part of which Mrs. Star Wars movie where she played the robot?
Solo. I was going to say. And I think we would kind of differ on that because I was going, okay, is this going to be like that slightly annoying robot? I don't know.
I mean, I literally find two things tolerable in Solo. Her character and Paul Bettany's cape. That's it. The only two elements of that movie that are any good. But I think that this might be good, for her to really break out. But other than that, yeah, it's hard watching Granddad try so hard to keep that fedora on his head.
I keep wondering, when is this going to be set? Because, if we go with, Harrison Ford's actual age and such, is this going to take place in like the 60s or even the 70s?
They're just going to do that weird waxy CGI thing they did to Jeff Bridges in Tron.
But I'm thinking if this takes place in like the early 70s, that suddenly now, I'm in Indiana Jones's timeline, which is weird because Indiana Jones was all like way back in the past.
I would be totally down for Indiana Jones having to deal with the 70s and being like a crotchety old man who's not getting disco music and bell-bottom pants. But I think as the Irishman proved to us, they can smooth out them wrinkles with CGI, and it may look a little weird, but they can put them in any time period they want now.
You could have Indiana Jones at Woodstock. That'd be something. Right? Do the split screen, just like the documentary. All right.
I would watch that.
Okay. So this bit of news I just saw today, and I was like, huh, that's interesting. There's not a lot of information on this. Apparently, in the realm of the live-action remakes, pseudo-remakes, things like that, we have news of a possible film based off of Cinderella's Evil Stepsisters, which is going to be written by and star Kristen Wiig and Annie Mamolo, which, of course, they're riding off of a degree of success with Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, which I haven't seen yet. I've got it from the library right now. I haven't gotten to watch it yet. But there's nothing really other than just that they're working on it. There's no title. There's no information. It's just an early development. But Cinderella's Evil Stepsisters. I guess I hadn't thought of that as a possibility for the live action remakes.
I'm very surprised this has not been mined endlessly for potential because Disney is really in the habit of taking characters that are evil and showing you that they had every reason to be that way and that they aren't. So I'm surprised this hasn't happened before. I love Annie Mamolo and Kristen Wiig. I'm not as big on Barb and Star as a lot of other people are. I did not intend for that to rhyme. but I love their take. I think Annie Mamolo is a very unsung screenwriter. And I'm interested in this. I think there could be some benefit to telling the story of two women who are told that they're not as pretty and are annoying compared to their hot stepsister. So I'd be down for this. I'm into it. I really like this concept.
So Kristen's been rooting for the stepsisters all along here, it sounds like.
I mean, Disney, again, is one of those that tries very hard to say that evil heroines have logic for their evilness, but they don't really know how to stick that landing. So who knows?
Yeah. All right. And then our last little bit of news here. This is now my official most anticipated movie of all time, because there has been the announcement that Disney and the Jim Henson Company are working on a project called Muppet Man, which is going to be a Jim Henson biopic. And of course, I'm a huge fan of the Muppets and all things Henson. When I think back to the public figures who most shaped my development as a young person and the things that I was interested in such, I think of people like George Lucas, Mr. Rogers, and Jim Henson. I'm very, very interested in this. It sounds like it's going to be written by Michael Mitnick, the writer of The Current War, really no other information as far as casting or directors is out there yet, but I'm definitely down for a Jim Henson biopic.
I'm definitely down for this. I wish we had a better screenwriter, because The Current War and The Giver, which is what Michael Mitnick is associated with, are not good movies. They do not have good scripts. So I'm hoping that maybe this guy's got something that we just haven't seen yet within him, because I think Henson really does deserve a decent biopic that looks at him, warts and all. I'm interested also to know what source material they're basing this off of. It sounds like the family is heavily involved, which is always troubling with the biopics. You know, family tends to glorify. Sure. If they're going off of the biography that came out a couple years ago by Brian J. Jones, which is a book that made me cry, I would think we have some really great material to work with. I was trying to think of somebody who could play Jim.
I was too. I am really struggling to think who they could cast as Jim Henson.
Because you need somebody like tall and very lanky and angular, and that's a distinct look, you know.
Yeah.
I'd have to think about that a little bit more. Maybe Christian Bale. I don't like it, but it's just off the top of my head.
Maybe. I'm not sure. All right. Well, that's all the news that we have this time. So let's talk about a short.
Down the stream and through the canyon, down the rushing...
So our short this time takes us back to 1937. It's one of the last of the Silly Symphony series. The Silly Symphony series wrapped up in 1939. So this is definitely at the tail end of that series. This is Little Hiawatha. It takes its inspiration from the Song of Hiawatha. It's a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, though this film really has very little to do with that poem. It's directed by David Hand, which makes perfect sense when you watch this. Hand also was kind of the primary director on Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And Snow White, of course, came out in 1937 as well. It came out in, I think, October of 37. This comes out in May of 37, so just a few months before. And there are definitely quite a few stylistic similarities, which I'm sure we'll get into in a moment here. But this follows a little Native American boy named Hiawatha as he goes out on a canoe trip, goes out to do some hunting. And at first, the animals don't seem, you know, very intimidated by him and all that. He tries to first hunt a grasshopper before turning his attention to a rabbit, but he can't bring himself to shoot the rabbit when he's got it cornered. He even gives the rabbit like a little bow and arrow so they can do like a little duel Hamilton style type of thing. But even that, you know, he just can't bring himself to shoot the cute little critter. And then he eventually, picks up on some bear tracks. He follows the bear tracks and then has an encounter with a cub. But of course, wherever there's a bear cub, the mama is nearby. And soon the larger bear starts chasing him, and the other animals that he had mercy on previously then kind of joined forces to help him escape the hungry bear. So this is one that I definitely seen images of in the past, popping up in like Disney books and things like that, but I had never seen it before.
This one I had seen before several times. It was very popular on the Disney Channel at one point before, you know, they stopped showing stuff and cultural sensitivities changed. But I had never read the original poem. I have read the Song of Hiawatha, which is the Coleridge Taylor iteration. But this is a weird short because, you know, they're going off of Longfellow's poem, but they're not really using it for anything other than name recognition.
Right.
Because it doesn't hold anything with the original poem. And so it really just does become a cute baby story. You know how Disney,
yes.
You know how Disney is very well known for making cute versions of all of their characters, whether that's Baby Dory, Baby Moana. And, you know, the whole point is that they're cute. And that's really the guise of it. This is where it starts. And I don't even think this was where it starts, because they did stuff similar to this in Winkin, Blinkin, and Nod.
Mer-babies, you know, things like that.
Well,
yeah.
Exactly. All of those baby ones. This, I feel, is very much in the vein of that, in that it's just there to, oh, look at the cute animation. look at how cute he is. I do like that, you know, him and the, he's got the little bow and arrow. The bunny has a little bow and arrow. And, you know, I think that's, again, this is a very cute short that is far too reliant on baby butt.
Yes, there are no less than three butt jokes in this because, yeah, his pants keep falling down. And I mean, it's not even like you just get a slight butt crack or anything. It's full on. There it is.
It's very. Yeah, it's a lot of butt. And also, I mean, it is also hard to, even though this is softening the original poem, it's not using it. It's still very much a white interpretation of this story in that Hiawatha is incredibly light-skinned, and there's really no reason to make it a Native American character short of, again, that name recognition. And really, nowadays, you don't really want to be associated with the Song of Hiawatha because the original poem is so synonymous with the stereotype of the noble savage, which we're still dealing with the fallout of that. So it's just, it's a very weird little short.
Yeah, I mean, it's one, well, first of all, you're right that, it, you know, there's nothing about it that really says it's got to be a Native American little boy. It could have been anyone. It could have been just, you know, some little kid playing in the backyard, you know, with a, you know, pop gun or something like that. You know, I mean, it, you know, kid playing hunter, whatever. It's one of those where I watch it and I go, well, yeah, it's just cute. It's just cutesy. I was expecting you to throw out that word you've often thrown out when we talk about these cute little kid cartoons, and that's Cupid doll, you know, the Cupid doll look of the characters. And I especially with those butt jokes that happen over and over again, I kept thinking, oh yeah, it's just, you know, it's like a little doll here. At the same time, it's one that I watch and I go, well, you know, it's pretty harmless. It's not really, you know, got anything that's too, let's say, difficult to deal with. You know, I mean, you know, I have the Disney Treasures sets and, you know, they didn't even put this one in the Leonard Maltin has to do an introduction, you know, section. You know, it's just kind of cute little kid walking around the forest type of a thing. I think really the main thing with this film is that it is interesting to look at just for, I think, its place in Disney history, because when we think about 1937 specifically and what they were going to achieve with Snow White just a few months after this, I think you can really see where, you know, the animators are kind of testing things out and stretching themselves. And I think especially with the way they portray the animals in this, I mean, a lot of it looks like it's the same stuff that's in those scenes in Snow White where all the animals are gathering around her and ooing and aahing and all that kind of stuff.
You're totally right. It's just a short that rests on the laurels of a lot of the other shorts before it. And it does have an opulence to it in terms of how it looks, but it's been there, done that scenario. It's easy to see why they were transitioning away from this concept into other things, because it really does feel like somebody was like, was reading the Song of Hiawatha one week and was like, we can turn this into a short, but we don't actually want to do any of these things. So we're just going to make it, you know, what was he doing as a baby? Which is just kind of weird to do, especially since the Song of Hiawatha is such a long, it's an epic. I mean, it's an epic poem. Right. And there's a lot of history that happens. This is a life, you know, womb to tomb narrative. And to just take the name and then not do it, I mean, you could, like you said, this could be about a cowboy, or it could just be about a little kid wanting to become a man. It doesn't have to be associated with Native Americans.
Yeah, yeah. One thing that you said there that was interesting too, where you kind of talked about, you know, that this was the changing of things, you know, where Disney was, you know, moving past what they had done before, all that kind of stuff. Or you know, that kind of the formula was no longer, you know, they couldn't just do the same formula all the time. And I found it interesting that this is one of the Silly Symphonies, but there's really very little emphasis on music in this one. I mean, there is music, but it's not like where, you know, those other Silly Symphonies, it's very much you have a piece of music and then you're just doing animation along with it, you know, critters dancing around or whatever. This is one that very much has a narrative to it, and the music is more like a score where it's emphasizing different actions on the screen. They're not animating to the music, they're composing music to the animation, and that seems to be, you know, the antithesis of what the Silly Symphonies have been throughout most of their history.
You're totally right. I was going to say that I didn't even notice music at all. It's not really adhering to the Silly Symphonies aesthetic at all. There's nothing memorable about this aside from the butt. I cannot stress the butt enough.
Yeah. Now, before we move on here, one thing I'll just throw out is that, you know, they have used the little Hiawatha character a few times since this, primarily in comics. I guess that back in the early 40s, there was actually a weekly Silly Symphonies comic strip that ran on Sundays in newspapers. And they did an adaptation of this as a part of that series. And then they've also used the character a few times in some of the Disney comic books that came about in the years following this. So it is a character that they've used a few times beyond this short. You know, like I said, it, you know, it's not a great narrative and such. I think it's interesting to look at, though, just in terms of what Disney would go on to after it. But that's kind of the main significance of this one, I think. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll hear from another Land Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our look at Pocahontas.
Hi, I'm Chris.
And I'm John.
And we are the hosts of the Popcorn Auteur, a movies podcast, where each episode we immerse ourselves in and critique the works of a famous filmmaker.
The concept is pretty straightforward. Chris and I pick a famous filmmaker, watch their films over a short time frame, then we talk about the films, mispronounce French words, and answer definitively. Is this filmmaker an auteur, and do we like them?
Subscribe and download episodes on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play.
You think you own whatever land you land on. The earth is just a dead thing you can claim. But I know every rock and tree and creature has a life, has a spirit, has a name. You think the only people who are people are the people who look and think like you. But if you walk the footsteps of a stranger, you'll learn things you never knew, you never knew. Have you ever heard the wolf cry to the blue corn moon? Or asked the grinning bobcat why he grinned? Can you sing with all the voices of the mountain? Can you paint with all the colors of the wind? Can you paint with all the colors of the wind?
So we are talking about the 1995 feature Pocahontas this week. This is directed by the directing team of Mike Gabriel and Eric Goldberg. Mike Gabriel, best known as the director of The Rescuers Down Under, the 1990 sequel to The Rescuers. He also did some story art on Bolt and was an animator for various places, but this was actually his last feature. The only other one he did after that was a 2004 short called Lorenzo. As for Eric Goldberg, he was is best known more for his work in the animation department as well. He was animation director for the upcoming Space Jam sequel, but this was actually his directorial debut. He would go on to do some segments for Fantasia 2000 and was the animation director for Looney Tunes Back in Action.
I think Goldberg, where I tend to think of him, and correct me if I'm wrong, I want to say he's the main animation guru on the Genie for Aladdin. That's where he kind of came to prominence. Yeah.
Exactly. And this, this has, I am not kidding when I tell you, a script written by 1,000 people. it is a script credited to Carl Binder, Susanna Grant, and Philip Lezebnik, but it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 story credits, plus several more additional story developments, which means rewrites. So this was a patchwork film made by a lot of people. But it tells the story of Pocahontas, voiced by Irene Bedard, who is the daughter of the chief of the Powhatan tribe, and what happens when she meets British colonist John Smith, voiced by Mel Gibson, who comes to the town with his colonial friends, and they found Jamestown, and they're looking for gold, but of course the Native Americans don't have gold, and the Brits don't care, but the two fall in love, and colonialism. Todd, did you see this movie in theaters?
I did.
When it came out in
95. Yes, 95. The year after my wife and I moved out here to Colorado. So we were newlyweds. We didn't have kids yet. But we went to every Disney animated film when it opened. And I remember going to see this in the theater. Actually, we were on a work trip, so I wasn't even at home. I think we were in Michigan, and we went and saw this after a week of working at a conference or something like that. The Disney animated films were ones that we checked out in the theaters all the time back when we, you know, didn't have to figure out kids and all those kinds of things. This is a film that's got an interesting history. It's one that it's interesting to hear people talk about because, I think opinions vary a lot on this film. It's one where, I recognize certain challenges with it. It's also one, though, that I have a lot of appreciation for on certain levels. And it's one that I think there's a lot of folks out there who actively want people to hate this movie. And though I can recognize some of the challenges, I can't hate this movie. I think there's a lot to enjoy here. I think it's important to realize this is a fantasy. I mean, even though we're dealing with historical figures, this is a fantasy movie,
So I saw this when it came out. I want to say that we saw this at the drive-in, and it was far from my favorite. And I feel like this marks a turning point for Disney in that it's the mid-90s, merchandising is a thing, and they really want to make that sweet, sweet merchandising money. I remember a lot of Pocahontas toys and Happy Meal stuff. There was a lot of marketing associated with this.
I still have the Burger King glasses that you could get.
Yes, I remember those. Yeah. I remember those. But at the same time, there was also a desire to tell more serious stories and get the awards recognition. This was before The Hunchback of Notre Dame, but I see a lot of commonalities to The Hunchback of Notre Dame in that both tell very serious stories in a way that tries so hard to please all comers and ends up falling flat in some places. And I think the biggest thing with Pocahontas to watch it now and really to watch it after it came out as you get older, if you know the bare modicum of not just history but current events at all, it's hard to sit through this very happy fantasy story that posits a lot of stuff. And that was a big problem, which is why there's so many screenwriters with this. They could not find a way to make this story incredibly palatable for an audience, considering what we now know about the colonization of indigenous people in this country. But you mentioned that there's a lot of interesting backstory to this, but director Mike Gabriel, after they released The Rescuers Down Under, he wanted to do an adaptation of Swan Lake with a Disney artist named Joe Grant. And so they started doing this Swan Lake adaptation, but they couldn't get it greenlit. They said, quote, supposedly the notes from the outline they got was, quote, there is no movie here, no story. And so they decided during a Thanksgiving weekend in 1990, Mike Gabriel decided to adapt Western legends like Annie Oakley and Buffalo Bill into an animated film. And then when that didn't go anywhere, he actually wrote a title during a pitch meeting, Walt Disney's Pocahontas, and put it on an image of Tiger Lily from Peter Pan. And the original pitch that he wrote, which I think says so much, was, quote, an Indian princess who is torn between her father's wishes to destroy the English settlers and her wishes to help them. A girl caught between her father and her people and her love for the enemy. And at the same time, supposedly they were developing an animated version of Romeo and Juliet. Disney in the 90s was just weird. And the feature president, Peter Schneider, saw a lot of commonalities between this Pocahontas project and what he was pitching. So they decided to mush it together. And Jeffrey Katzenberg, who at the time was the studio chairman of Disney, really felt that this was going to be their Oscar film, that this was going to be, like Beauty and the Beast, nominated for Best Picture. And so while they were concurrently working on Aladdin and The Lion King, he went full in on this Pocahontas story. And there was a lot of issues on adding broad jokes, wanting to make it very gentle. How do you do the political correctness of the story without going overboard with it? And the 92 LA riots happened, and Eric Goldberg, who joined the production as co-director, decided that he wanted to focus on the racial themes between Pocahontas and John Smith, which, okay, that's a way to take that story. And they got, you know, the best of the best with their Broadway music, and they put so much money into this movie. And they also hired a lot of Native American consultants to look at the clothing and the war dance choreography. That's what you hire the consultants for. Okay. As a result, you know, they thought this was going to be a very prestigious movie. And I will say, I do love the music. I think the music in Pocahontas is fantastic. It's a little trite, but it's good. You know, Savages is like some of the best music in Hunchback. It's here. It's in this movie, too. But it's just so silly in so many ways. And how it, I mean, I get that it's aimed at children in some ways with its love story. But, ooh, there's some things that happen in here.
I think, you know, it is important to remember that this is made for children. I mean, you know, I've read a lot of things leading up to this, and there's some things that I read where people were complaining about the historical inaccuracies, you know, et cetera, all that. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, I get it. That's nothing new in the world of the movies, okay? If you're complaining about that on Pocahontas, you haven't seen any other movies, I guess. But, you know, but here's the thing. The thing I just keep remembering is, yeah, this is made for kids, and I think, for the most part, I think this film has its heart in the right place. It is, you know, trying to say some things about the coming together of different types of people, about getting along, about, you know, however you want to interpret it. Okay. It is a stuff that's very difficult to do with a kid's movie, you know, and I think that they're not going to hit on the things that some folks are going to want them to hit on. I mean, that's a given. You know, I think that, you know, when it's all said and done, I think that there's clear evidence they're trying for a good thing. Some things don't quite hit the mark. I think where I struggle with it a bit is I can watch this and go, okay, there's going to be limitations. There's going to be some things where they don't quite nail it. I think where I struggle a bit is that though there's a lot of things I marvel at with this film, the story is, I think, so just simplistic and not that interesting, especially when you compare it to, you know, some of the other films of this era, you know, especially if we're looking at the other love stories of the era. I mean, this is a far cry from Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it wants so desperately to be Beauty and the Beast, so much so. And, you know, as somebody who watched a lot of Disney growing up, you know, Pocahontas, I feel, is where Disney gets their whole concept of rebel girl equals personality, you know, and in something like The Little Mermaid, we know what Ariel wants, right? She's a very clear want in that movie. She wants to be part of that world. She wants to be up above. Pocahontas really doesn't have that want. She doesn't want to get married to the Native American man that she has promised to.
Kokoum, yeah.
Kokoum. I think that her want is John Smith, and if her want is a white man, like, it's really reductive. And that's, I think, the biggest issue is she's a rebel, but she's a rebel literally without a cause. You know, her cause is to save this to save John Smith. It's not even really a unity thing. You know, the unity, quote unquote, comes purely by accident at the end of this. And I think that that is because you're trying to diffuse a lot of complex themes in this. I mean, it's the biggest thing that I always notice, especially now as we're far more cognizant of it, is that the Pocahontas story as it's been written by you know, men, is that, you know, this is a love story. And when you read, like, historically, the Pocahontas was a 10-year-old child, and, you know, she was captured by the English and, you know, was kind of held as a totem of this noble, savage civilization thing. You know, it is hard to really watch her be moony-eyed over John Smith. You know, and then you find out that they actually based her look on non-Native Americans, you know, like Kate Moss, Naomi Campbell, Christy Turlington, right. Supermodels were her inspiration. I mean, she really is a character, I think, that is not sexualized, you know, by costuming, but she is.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I mean, but she is representative, I think, of a lot of the exotic Native, you know, that we've seen in stuff like Aladdin. You know, or other movies where there is this exoticism to being a woman from this other you know, tribe, and that is hard to parcel out, especially when you add in the fact that she doesn't really have a whole lot. Her dream is to listen to her heart, but what does that mean? Where does that take her?
Right. I think you hit the nail on the head on a few things there. I mean, one of the things I put down in my notes is that, you know, we don't have a clear picture of what her desires are, what her wants are. You know, when we think about these other Disney princesses, and we've talked about this many times before, you know, and we'll get into the music more later, but all of them have the I Want song. Little Mermaid has it. Beauty and the Beast has it. And I think that, you know, we don't only get the song in those films, but we get a deeper understanding of what the desires of Belle or Ariel are as the film progresses. I think with Pocahontas, we get the I Want song and that's it. And it's the I Want song is vague. You know, I mean, I like Just Around the River Bend, but it's like, well, there's something out there for me just around the river bend, but what is it? You know, it's kind of like, it's just left hanging out there. We don't really get a clear picture of the hopes and desires of our lead character. And I would say the same thing applies also to John Smith. There's a brief musical I Want moment for John Smith that comes in the Mine, Mine, Mine song, where he's talking about how he wants adventure and a land that he can discover and all this kind of stuff. And again, it ends there. We really have no deep understanding of who these two characters are. They just, you know, start getting mushy and fall in love.
Pocahontas wants John Smith. John Smith wants to be Christopher Columbus. That's pretty much what it is. And I mean, the voice actors do a really good job. I mean, Irene Bedard does a good job of making Pocahontas seem very delicate, but also strong-willed. You know, the voice cast isn't anything special there.
There's no real iconic voices of this, I would say.
No.
Yeah, it's not like when you have Sebastian in Little Mermaid is so recognizable, or even Jodie Benson, okay, as Ariel. I mean, there's something just iconic about that. And here, you know, the voice performance is good, but it just doesn't jump out at you.
I will give them credit for, you know, Irene Bedard is an Alaskan Native actress. They actually did cast authentically. They did not cast a white woman.
She plays Pocahontas's mother in another film, I believe.
In The New World. New World, yeah. Which I feel is a bit more authentic. Although her singing voice by Judy Kuhn is, I believe Judy is from New York. So So, you know, go figure there. I mean, Mel Gibson, this was before we knew who Mel Gibson was. You know, he does a good job as John Smith. I do find it funny that he's supposed to be, you know, British colonialist, and he's Australian, which yeah. was a country founded for convicts. So, you know, weird little colonizing joke there. But his John Smith is very much in the vein of a lot of male characters that we now know as kind of creeps, you know, where I think is, what is it, Megara in Hercules sums up so well, like, no means yes, and, you know, yes means take me, I'm yours. And that's, that happens a lot in this movie, where Pocahontas is like, no, this is horrible, you're a horrible person. He's like, no, I'm not letting you leave until you say that you forgive me. You know, where his charm is just supposed to be very smarmy. And the English in this incarnation, which, by the way, John Smith was like a ginger-headed, like, 5'2" guy. He did not look like a blonde Adonis, okay?
Oh, he's a, you talk about supermodels, he's a supermodel in this, yeah.
But the English in this film are, you know, it's funny to find out that they based a lot of this on the 92 riots in LA, because a lot of the English in this movie are sold as, they're not bad. It's just one bad apple. It's just one bad guy. And in this case, it's Governor Ratcliffe, voiced by David Ogden Steers, our Cogsworth, if memory yeah. serves. Yeah. He's also the voice of Wiggins. There's, you know, yeah. we want to talk about.
He plays
about,
the villain and the henchman.
Well, if we want to talk about, you know, there's issues with the racial component, but there's also a lot that's been written about this movie's presentation of the FOP and queer characters, because Wiggins is very stereotypically femme in this movie. But the English here, you know, Ratcliffe is the villain. It's not them. They're all going to Jamestown as the land of opportunity, and it's, you know, they're just a bunch of nice dudes. And I think at one point John Smith tells Pocahontas, you know, you don't know, you know, where he's talking about schools and civilization, right? And she says, I don't want that. And he's like, you don't know that you don't want that. You just don't know that yet.
Yeah.
And that's really how this movie plays with a lot of complex themes, which is like, John Smith isn't a colonizer, you know, in the way that like Black Panther makes fun of colonizers. He's just a guy that is just trying to better this land, man. Like, who doesn't want guns and houses? Like, who doesn't want all those Hamilton things, right?
Well, I mean, to be fair, though, I think, you know, you can definitely say they make a point of kind of showing John Smith's attitudes, at least as the film begins, as being misguided. You know, it's not like he just stays that way or anything like that. Okay. You know, I mean, you know, they very much point, you know, paint the settlers as being the villains, you know, and I mean, in more ways than one. I mean, I, you know, one thing that I found interesting, and, you know, I want to, you know, talk a little bit more about the look specifically of Pocahontas as we go on, because, you know, you were talking about sexualizing and whatnot, and I think Pocahontas has, well, let's just say, you know, they paint her as one of the sexiest of the Disney princesses, I think. But what I found interesting is that, you know, the English characters are for the most part presented as, other than John Smith, like I say, John Smith's very strapping and, you know, looks like an underwear model. But these other guys are bizarre looking. They're freakish in some ways. I mean, our main villain is, you know, just looks nothing like an actual human being. And, you know, for the most part, the other British settlers are all have really weird, exaggerated faces. You know, a lot of them are very pot-bellied and stuff. There's a few where they really, you know, exaggerate some older characters. I remember there's one that looks really raggled and has an eye patch and a raggly beard and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, when you compare that to the way that the natives are presented, they're all strapping and strong and muscular. I don't think we see anybody in that film, you know, that looks over the age of 35, even Powhatan, who's supposed to be the older, wiser guy, you know, looks, you know, like a strapping young man.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. There's a lot of emphasis on virility. And even though this movie is titled Pocahontas, it's really a story about men and men shaping the world in their image. And that extends to the natives too. You know, Powhatan is very much in the vein of King Triton in that he knows what's best for his daughter, right? And unlike King Triton, who wants to keep his daughter under the sea, Powhatan wants to marry Pocahontas off to Kokoam. And that's her lot in life. And the movie really doesn't seem to rectify that. And at times I feel like Pocahontas really gets lost in the... Here's a great example. I remember a lot of the toys marketed to girls about Pocahontas were Pocahontas and her forest friends. You know, go into the woods with Pocahontas and her little, you know, hummingbird and her raccoon and talk to the tree. And it wasn't anything having to do with the plot of this movie. It was little girls like the woods. You know, little girls like flowers and nature. And I feel that's often where Pocahontas gets left in this movie is, you know, she likes to jump off cliffs and be free spirited. But what is the bigger end game for her?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that whole thing with the animals and all that kind of stuff. I mean, we were talking about Snow White earlier. And it made me think of Snow White in a lot of ways, just those moments where, you know, all the animals gather around and are gazing with wonder at what Snow White is doing and all that. And you get that same type of thing here. And I thought, as I was watching it, I go, wow, I really kind of thought we had moved past that. Because when you look at those earlier animated features, I mean, it happens in Snow White, it happens in Cinderella, it happens in Sleeping Beauty, you know, where all the animals gather around, et cetera, et cetera. And we didn't get that kind of thing in, you know, like The Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast, you know. And here now suddenly we're back in 1937 again with that motif. And it feels awkward here at times.
It really does. You bring up a great comparison in Snow White. And I feel that that's where this movie treats Pocahontas more than anything. You can make fun of the reductiveness of the racial dynamics or the historical context. But I think why Pocahontas fails the most, Pocahontas often gets compared to Moana a lot. Moana is said to build on Pocahontas and do it better. But Pocahontas really is the story of a woman who is just torn between a dude and him not wanting to die. You know, that's really, I mean, her biggest choice in this movie ends up being trying to sacrifice herself for him. And that's really hard to get behind, you know, especially if you look at later incarnations of Pocahontas, you know, something like Terrence Malick's The New World, which ironically has Christian Bale in it as well. He's also in this movie.
Yeah, we didn't mention that Christian Bale does a voice
Christian
in this.
Christian Bale is, yes, in this movie, because he had also done Newsies right around this time. But Pocahontas really historically was the favored daughter of Powhatan. He had several children, several wives, but she had power as a member of this community. And we don't get any of that. You know, we don't know what her station is in this family, in the tribe itself. She is just there to be a bargaining chip, to be a princess in the most reductive way possible, which is to choose between which man she wants to be. And the man dictates what her life will be. So Kokoam, as she says in the song, is steady like the river. He represents what she is supposed to do. Whereas John Smith is like the motorcycle, rocking, like, leather coat, like, bad boy that she's not supposed to be with, that represents all this other stuff. But that's not an interesting story.
Well, you know, actually, I mean, the more we talk about it, the more I realize that, you know, a lot of this is really stitching together certain elements from some of the films that preceded it, as far as, you know, just to weave our story together. I mean, the more you were describing what they were wanting out of Pocahontas there, you know, they're going for Belle. You know, they're going for she's kind of aloof. You know, she's you know, they don't understand why she's always going off and doing her own thing.
Weird.
You know, yes, you know, she really is a funny girl, that Pocahontas, you know, and, you know, and then you have like the element of these the playful side characters, which I struggle with a bit in this, where you have, you know, like the raccoon and the hummingbird and ultimately the dog as well, you know, which
there's so many animal sidekicks in this movie. Yeah. It just becomes insane.
And, you know, they're probably going for, you know, a scuttle, a Sebastian, a flounder type of thing, but it's not quite the same. You know, I mean, when we get down to, as the story is coming to its climax and all that, I mean, you mentioned before the Savages song. Savages is the mob song Mark II. I mean, it's pretty much just, let's do that song again, but a little bit different. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
I mean, they really are just kind of patching together a bunch of different things here. I do want to jump back just to talk about the look of Pocahontas. Because like I was saying, I think this is one of the ones that comes to mind most when I think about how they were really kind of pushing the envelope when it comes to presenting an attractive female. I mean, we talked about Esmeralda when we talked about the Hunchback, and we said how, you know, there's definitely a sexuality there that we don't
pole
see.
Dancing, Todd.
Yeah, I know. And we don't pole have dancing. That. We don't have that degree in this, but I do think they do some things that, you know, like when you read that they did inspire the look of her from, you know, various supermodels and things like that. I mean, I can see it, you know, the sequence where John Smith first meets Pocahontas and they're there in the river and the waterfall's behind her and she stands up slowly and dramatically. I'm like, this is the SI swimsuit issue, Disney edition. You know, it's that kind of thing, the way the hair is flowing and all that stuff.
You bring up a great point, which, and I think that that's the most insulting thing about this movie, is that you look at Esmeralda, and yes, they play on the stereotype of gypsy women being promiscuous, being exotic and sexy and pole dancing. But this goes the complete opposite, which is Native American woman. She's not a squaw per se, but she is that Longfellow, like we're talking about with Hiawatha, the noble savage. She is the noble woman. She is the good woman who is morally right and prim. And I mean, look at the way the camera, the animation frames her, you know, looking over her shoulder with the wind blowing through her long hair.
Yeah.
You know, it's enough to make you think of those old commercials from the 1970s with like the crying Native American with the littering, right? I mean, it's very stoic and it's very cold almost. You know, Pocahontas is captivating because she's beautiful, because she can convey so much by being silent. You know, and she's dignified. And that's really, I think, the most just disturbing element of this movie, is that Pocahontas could have been a real way for Native women to see themselves, especially young Native American girls. And there's nothing relatable about her at all. There's, you know, she's magic, right? She can talk to trees and she can communicate with animals. I mean, she's otherworldly.
Yeah.
There's nothing that's authentic or feels relatable to her that young girls are going to gravitate to.
You're right. She, in that she feels like, you know, she kind of exists in a different space, you know, than even the other Native American characters. I mean, you know, we don't get the sense that the rest of them really have any connection to this mystical stuff that's going on, you know, the grandma willow, or, you know, the weird colorful leaves that float around and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, you talk about the exotic nature of things. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm struggling to remember if, other than her friend, if there are any other female Native American characters in this, even in the background.
None that she interacts with, none that I can remember. And I think that actually was brought up at one point in terms of Disney having to acknowledge the lack of mothers in this. Mm-hmm. You know, supposedly one of the early ideas was for her mom to be embodied in a star in the sky, that by the end of the film would help her find her path to John Smith, but The Lion King did that, so they couldn't do that. And Michael Eisner supposedly really pushed for Pocahontas to have a mother because of the criticism that they always killed the moms off.
Right.
But the writers ended up countering with, well, Powhatan was polygamous, and you know he would form dynastic alliances among neighboring tribes by impregnating women and giving away the child. So it was presumed that Pocahontas herself probably didn't see her mother that much. And Eisner was like, well, I guess that's not happening. So her mother's spirit became the swirling wind that occurs. And it's just, gosh, you know, you wish she had some other female characters because, yeah, Nakoma, who is the friend of hers, is really there just to kind of be the buzzkill, you know, and just be like, you're too rebellious. You need to do differently and act better. And that's not really a friend. That's, you know, that's a mother. It's not really a friendly character. I don't see Nakoma as really being a friend to her.
Well, and I found it interesting, too, just the contrast of the way that character is designed and animated and such. I mean,
very plainly.
I mean, that's the thing. If we've only got two female characters here, one of them is you know, portrayed as being very glamorous, like we say, modeled off of supermodels and things like that. And the other one is very much kind of a plain Jane. I mean, you know, I mean, just look at the differences in their costumes, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, exotic gown versus, you know, school uniform type of thing. You know what I mean?
Exactly. She's very dowdy, you know. Yeah. And I think, too, you also have that contrast with Kokoam and John Smith, too, you know, which I find to be really – I noticed it a lot this time around. You know, Powhatan is kind of like jacked, but he's covered. And John Smith is very much – kind of like what they did with Hercules, where he's statuesque. You know, he's got that jawline.
Oh, he's got the cheekbones. Yeah.
Yeah. He's very, very, you know, statuesque and, you know, looks like Superman, kind of. Whereas Kokoam is just like, this is how Native American. I think he is also sexualized, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he doesn't have a shirt on the entire time. You know, everything is like handprints on his pecs. It's a little insane. And then, you know, this is a guy that could be a completely nice guy. His biggest flaw, right, is that he's serious. It's the you know, Sleepless in Seattle issue is that, like, oh, his worst fault is that he's boring. And thus he dies. He is shot down in this, God, knowing that it was based on the 92 riots, like, wow. They shoot Christian Bale's character, Thomas, accidentally shoots him.
Oh, no. It's not an accident.
So it's intentional. He shoots him after Kokoam tries to kill him. So, like, both are wrong, both sides now. And that's what causes all this strife. But really, Pocahontas gets really upset. And I was like, girl, you barely talked to this dude. Like, I didn't feel her sadness.
Yeah. Let's move on to something a little cheerier. Let's hit on the music specifically, because, I mean, this is right in the heyday of the Disney musicals and such. And you mentioned that the songs, that you like the songs. I like the songs here too. I don't think they're as iconic as, you know, some of the others. You know, it's not Under the Sea or you know, Be Our Guest or things
it's
like that.
It's not even The Hunchback, which came out the next year. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, what are your favorites? What's your take on the songs here?
I do love Savages, you know, especially when...
You go for the darkest one.
I love the dark... Especially when Judy Kuhn's voice comes in. I think that, you know, it is a real building showstopper type of song. I wish that the animation didn't play it like a music video. But I do think it's a good song. I mean, Colors of the Wind. I mean, every girl I went to school with in, you know, fourth grade, we all sang Colors of the Wind.
It's a beautiful song. Yeah.
It's a good song. Just Around the River Bend, I always forget is in this movie because it sounds like Colors of the Wind, but it's not. So yeah, I mean, I think the songs are good. The Pocahontas songs, the Native American songs, I think are the best. The English songs, you know, Gold, they don't really stick with me.
I agree with you there. I think Colors of the Wind is great. I remember when they first started advertising this film, when the first trailers hit. The first trailer was actually Colors of the Wind. It was just that song, which they had done that with The Lion King as well. The Lion King, the first trailer was just showing you that first 4 minutes or so of the movie, the Circle of Life. In fact, I think when it hit the theaters, there might have even been some unfinished animation where it would like cut to a black and white sketch drawing or things like that. But anyway, it was very powerful, a great introduction to this movie that was still many months away from being released. And they did the same thing with Pocahontas, where the trailer was just Colors of the Wind, the full thing as it appears in the movie. And that's one of my favorite moments of the film. It's just the animation is beautiful in those moments. And so it was a great hook to just go, oh yeah, I got to see this movie. And I think it's that song is the standout for me in the whole thing. I think that the songs for this, well, I mean, it happens with all of the animated films, I guess, especially from this era, where the songs, the songs are very front heavy. You know, the songs come in the beginning of the film, and then we get a chunk of the movie where there's not much musically happening and all that. I kind of wish they would space things out a little bit better. I think that, like, the villain song for me almost comes too soon in this. You know, I like a little more build up to it, like we get in The Lion King. But still, I think it's an effective villain song, the mine thing. But I mean, overall, I don't have major complaints about the songs. I think they're quite good. They're just, you know, not quite as iconic as some of the other films that had come just before this.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I do want to, before we start talking about the park, is there park? There's park presence for this.
Boy, I don't know if there is, but yeah.
But marketing and box office. I do love that this movie ends with the stark belief that the Native Americans went to, or the colonizers went away, took John Smith back to England, and they never bothered the Native Americans. even if you and I've read the plot line to Pocahontas 2: A New Journey, which is the direct-to-video sequel to this movie, which touches on her relationship with John Rolfe and other things. And, oh, gosh. I mean,
it's on Disney Plus. You can watch it.
So I'll touch on the box office. This was released in honor of Pocahontas' 400th birthday in 1995. It played six theaters in North America, grossed $2.7 million its first weekend, which made it eighth in the box office. It did beat the record set by The Lion King the previous year due to opening on fewer than 50 screens. And that record has not been beaten. This has the highest grossing opening weekend for a movie that opened on fewer than 50 screens. It did wide release in June of 95. And the studio hoped that it was going to earn $30.5 million to get number one at the box office and beat out Batman Forever. And they had to revise that because the movie ended up being number two behind Batman Forever. It did narrowly rank first in its opening weekend with just $29.5 million. And Batman Forever made $29.2 million. So it was a squeaker. It did eventually gross $141.5 million in the U.S. It was the fourth highest grossing film in North America of 1995 behind Apollo 13, Batman Forever, and Toy Story, first Pixar movie.
Oh, yeah.
It was, though, at the time seen as a box office disappointment, especially compared to The Lion King. And the sales of merchandise was a big deal for this movie. This movie sold a lot of toys. It does have mixed reviews from critics. Right now, it has a 55% on Rotten Tomatoes. The general consensus is that it's a beautiful film, but is a very bland and uninspired effort with uneven plotting and an unfortunate lack of fun. Roger Ebert thought it was one of the best looking of the Disney animated films, though he did say that the story kind of sucked. And the fact that it did not have a lot of humor and the script was weak also was shouted out in reviews. And a lot of people had issues, especially Native American activists, with the historical context. So yeah, it's definitely one of the more mixed Disney features.
Yeah, I can get behind that. I do want to point out one of the things that was mentioned there, and just the look of it. We haven't really covered much, but I think this is absolutely a really beautifully animated film. I think that's where I kind of side a little bit higher on things when we ultimately get to rating, is because I just think there's some really interesting and beautiful animation going on here. I love the color scheme of this. So, you know, as far as the look goes, I think it's gorgeous.
Would definitely agree with you on that.
All right. So one thing we should hit on, too, is this did win two Oscars. Of course, both music Oscars, which was kind of the case for these films back at the time. Colors of the Wind won Best Original Song, and then Alan Menken won the Best Original Score. Actually, this was one of the years where they did two score categories, Best Original Musical or Comedy Score. And then they also had Best Dramatic Score. They did that for only like a 2 or 3 years, I remember.
I don't miss it.
All right, so let's do some pins on this one, and then our ratings. I mean, there's no shortage of Pocahontas pins, I'm sure, in the theme parks. But what you got on this one?
So for me, I do like Flit with the biscuit. I think that one's pretty funny. I do like the sequence of Nakoma and Pocahontas under the raft with the water. I think that one's really cool. And I do love just John Smith in the boat going back to America and his little raft as he's been shot, not making you think of all those times you played Oregon Trail knowing that septicemia was a real thing and that the odds of John Smith getting a horrible infection and dying en route were very real.
I don't have the patience for Oregon Trail. I sat down once to play that with someone. I was like, this is too complicated for my brain.
You always ford the river, okay?
I had a hard time thinking up any pins for this because I know there's, you know, a lot already out there. And I was like, there's just not that many iconic, quirky moments to this one that, you know, are the type of thing I like to see in a pin. You know, I mean, I thought like, you know, Pocahontas in the canoe, or, you know, like the Grandma Willow character. The Grandma Willow is kind of interesting. I like the animation of that. It's kind of a weird mix of hand-drawn and CGI stuff, you know, but I don't know. I just couldn't really think of any iconic moments. I mean, maybe some of the, you know, if you want to take some of the scenes and do like a screenshot of some of the just beautiful animation there, I could go for that. But that's about all I could think of. All right. So what are you going to rate this one on our scale of 5 Mickey heads?
You know, this is a movie I've seen more than once. It ends up being a good background Disney feature. I give this a 3 out of 5.
That's exactly what I was thinking as well. I give it a 3. It's one that, you know, it's certainly got its issues, but, you know, I think there's still things to enjoy, certainly on an artistic side. Like I said, I think that's why I maybe side with giving it a 3. So, yeah. That's going to do it on our discussion of Pocahontas. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this film or any of the other films that we've talked about. Please feel free to email us at waltsentmepodcast@gmail.com. You can also interact with us on Twitter at waltsentmepod or on Facebook, which is where?
Facebook.com/waltsentmepod.
And Kristen, please tell everybody where they can find you and your various projects.
I am always on Twitter at @journeys_film, and I do a classic film podcast called Ticklish Business, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can find me on Twitter at @ForgottenFilms. That's films with a Z. Be sure to check out my blog, which is called Forgotten Films. It's at ForgottenFilmcast.wordpress.com, and my other podcast, which is called The Forgotten Filmcast. All right, so what is the next movie we're going to be talking about?
I don't want to say it. We are going back in time to 1993, and we're going to be moving away from talking about historical inaccuracies to talking about the early attempts to adapt video games. So we are talking about Hollywood Pictures feature film adaptation of Super Mario Brothers.
With Dennis Hopper as a dinosaur man.
My brother made me watch this every week for a year in 94. And I vowed I would never watch it again.
Oh, well, you know, sometimes you gotta just take one for the team here, Kristen. I mean, come on. All right. Well, next time is going to be interesting for sure. Until then, we'll see you later.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.